Hello and welcome to Season 3, Episode 1 of the Summer Library Podcast. I am Paul Sorrell, along with Stephen Mount. Happy New Year to you, sir.
Happy New Year to you on this season premiere.
Yes, and is it too late in the year to be wishing you a Happy New Year?
There should be a certain rule of etiquette for that, I think. Maybe a week in seems about right.
Right, and as we record this, it's toward the end of January, and J-term ends tomorrow.
Yeah.
But it's our first episode of a new year, so
we can wish our listeners a Happy New Year.
Yes. Hopefully the first month of the new year has been successful.
It seems
for
like
them.
It's flown by so far.
It has.
Yeah,
it
it's
has
gone really fast.
So what's going on with you? Anything new in interlibrary loan world or library world?
It's funny you ask.
Oh, is it?
There is something new going on in ILL. There's a new service, an in-state courier called Firefly.
Firefly?
Yeah. We have a courier coming by on Tuesdays and Thursdays for pickups, and we hope this will produce a faster service, a way of receiving and sending off our books to quicker turnaround in the sending and receiving of books with this new courier service. So,
That's kind of cool.
Firefly, yeah.
And so they're going to take the place of UPS or the mail or like that?
It's just for Tennessee schools, so it's kind of limited in that regard. But, as opposed to sending books through the U.S. mail, we'll send books in the Firefly family in Tennessee using the Firefly courier.
How many schools are participating in this?
I think there's over 200.
Now, is it only schools, or is it also public libraries?
A few public libraries. It seems like it's more schools, more academic, but there are a few public libraries as well.
Okay. And that's going on now?
It is. All it's right. live this
it's
year.
Live. All
it's
right.
new this year.
Well, good. There's also a new database that the library has, and it's called Credo Reference. And it's kind of a cool thing. It's really just offers general reference titles in a wide variety of subject areas. But you can also go to the topics page and look up your topics. It's a good place to start your research. Mm-hmm. And what the cool thing about it is it also links database entries of things that we have in other databases. Oh. So if you're looking for a particular topic, and it'll search some other databases that we have as well. So you can use it to do all sorts of stuff. You can find things that are in encyclopedias and dictionaries, biographies, quotations, bilingual dictionaries, crossword solver. So there's a lot of things that you can do with this new database called Credo Reference. So look for it on the database page.
Credo Reference.
Credo Reference. And another highlight of a database, which we probably had a while, but this is World Book Advanced, and it's part of the Tennessee Electronic Library resources, and it gives you full text resources and primary source documents and ebooks, and it also has links to a couple of Tennessee newspapers, one being the Commercial Appeal from Memphis and the other being the Tennessean from Nashville. So lots of resources that we have, lots of good stuff if you just, you know, kind of drill down in them. And also the research guides that our librarians have put together for different subjects. And if you've ever looked at that, man, they've put a lot of effort and a lot of time into finding things for people to search. And I know Ann and Beth did one on travel, just for fun. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of interesting if you have a trip coming up that if you want to go to this research guide and get all sorts of information about different things for travel. So that is pretty cool.
These are all linked to from the library's website. And the library guides is where I start people off with research questions at the front when I'm at the front desk. It's an excellent place to start and really provides a lot of subject-specific databases and helps that way. So,
do you ever stand in amazement at the amount of information that we have access to? Just, you know, in the library specifically, but in the world in general. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah. I think there's a phrase out there, Google is our brain now.
Which is kind of scary.
Yeah. We don't have to remember. We don't have to recall things.
Yeah.
We just get on Google, and which I don't know if that makes us smarter or not.
But, yeah, I don't know. I mean, it has positives, but it also has some negatives because if you can't do basic math in your head, or if you don't remember facts from things.
Not using calculators in a math class and doing that on your own, but now you don't have to recall any sort of factual information on your own. You can just go to Google and Google will tell you the answer.
Yeah. Did you see Les Mis?
I did see Les Mis, yeah.
I saw Les Mis.
Excellent.
Oh, it was great.
Yeah.
It was great, except for Russell Crowe's questionable singing.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sorry. He doesn't have the chops for it.
I thought he acted it fairly well.
Yeah.
And he was a believable person in that role. I don't know. If they're going for realistic truth, and the feeling of and not all professional singers and more emotional, maybe that's what they're going for. I don't know. And that everybody didn't have to be a Broadway quality singer. But it was overall great movie.
Yeah. It's a movie that has a lot of depth to it.
Yeah.
And it has a lot of meaning to it. And it has such a beautiful spiritual part to it. Yeah. I hope it wins. It won some Golden Globes, so hopefully it'll win some Oscars. And, of course, the big football game coming up in about a week.
The Pro Bowl?
The Super Bowl.
The Pro Bowl. You're talking about the Super Bowl.
The Super Bowl.
Yeah.
And you and I, what was this, back in
June, I think,
we made predictions as to who we thought would be in the Super Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so excited because I saw Peter King, who is affiliated with Sports Illustrated and Sunday Night Football with NBC, come out on a show and say his picks for the Super Bowl, which just happened to be the picks I had made.
Whose picks came out first, I wonder?
I believe my picks came out first. But unfortunately, both picks got thumped the same weekend. So
both of my picks.
Yours didn't even make it
to the
playoffs.
Neither made the playoffs, no.
So who did you pick?
I don't know. It's hard to remember. June was a long time back.
Yeah.
Well, they have as many Super Bowl championships this year as your team, so.
Well, that's true. I had chosen the Denver Broncos and the Green Bay Packers, and they got eliminated the same weekend, I didn't feel bad. So of the two remaining teams, who do you want to win, and then who do you think will win?
Well, I don't particularly have a strong love for either team, but if I had to choose between the two, my desire would be for San Francisco to win.
Right.
My prediction would probably be the Ravens winning.
Okay, so you're predicting the Ravens, but you would like the Niners to win.
Right.
I would like the Niners to win, and I'm going to predict that they're going to win.
Okay.
They have never lost a Super Bowl.
That's right.
The organization.
Also no longer have Joe Montana as their quarterback.
Well, that's true. I mean, it's a different team, obviously, but the organization has never lost. So hopefully that will keep going.
We'll see.
We'll see. And we got some big news, an announcement here on campus a few weeks ago with Dr. Dockery.
Yeah.
Our president, saying that he would be stepping down from his role as president in 2014.
Mid-2014.
And would become the chancellor.
So, more of an advisory type position.
Mm-hmm.
Still involved with Union, but no longer president.
Right.
He will have been at Union for 19 years.
I think once, this transition's complete, 19 years.
Right.
So
it's a long time.
Yeah, it is. And he's been an excellent president.
I think they said the lifespan of a university president is about 7 years average.
Wow.
So,
yeah, close to three times that much.
Right.
So we wish him well in his transition and his new role. And speaking of things presidential, we are very delighted to have as our guest today Dr. Sean Evans, who is a political science professor here at Union.
And resident expert on all things presidential and
political.
Political.
Yeah, and we will be talking about the presidency in that office of the United States.
Timely with the inauguration just a few days back.
Right, and some of his thoughts about where we are and what we will most likely see in the next few years. So it should be a very interesting conversation, and we will be back with Dr. Evans right after this. Dr. Sean Evans is Associate Professor and Chair of the Department of Political Science here at Union. He is a graduate of Lipscomb University and completed his Master of Arts degree at the University of Alabama and his Ph.D. at the University of Colorado. His expertise is in the elections, the American national institutions of Congress, the presidency, and the courts. His research has been published in American Politics Quarterly, Vital Statistics of American Politics, and the Encyclopedia of the United States Constitution. He is currently researching strategic retirement from the House of Representatives and U.S. Senate. We are pleased to have Dr. Evans join us today on our podcast. Welcome.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Now, for a political scientist like yourself, I am assuming that this is the greatest season of all. You know, you've got the presidential elections, you got inauguration, you got all these things going on. So is it?
Well, I like to think that I always have the greatest season of all, because in politics, things are constantly changing. There's something always going on. If there's not an election, you've got legislation and policy fights. You've got inaugurations. You've got world events. So I look at it as I get to study a field that is exciting every single day.
Do you ever get tired of it?
No. No, I don't get tired of it, but typically when I go on vacation, I don't read anything about politics, and I enjoy that too. So, yes.
And do you ever get tired of the politics within the political system, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I think everyone gets frustrated with what they see go on. I think that's typical. I guess from my perspective, I look at it as a lot of the frustration we see is actually the founder systems being put into action. Mm-hmm. Our founders created a system which meant to promote conflict, which meant to prevent laws from being passed. So a lot of things that we complain about today is actually our system working well.
Right. Whether we like it or not.
Whether we like it or not. It's one of these things where short term, we don't like it, but long term, I think it's a very good system.
Right, right. When did the office of President of the United States of America become the most powerful office in the world?
Well, I think there's two ways of looking at that. First, we have to look at when did it become the most powerful office in this nation? Because for the first 120, 30 years of the American experiment, the presidency was not a very powerful office. The president was supposed to defer to Congress and do what they wanted. It probably wasn't until Teddy Roosevelt that he tried to create the office of the president into a more powerful office that would guide the nation. He referred to it as he was the steward of the nation, mm-hmm. in that respect. And Woodrow Wilson tried to continue that tradition on. And of course, Franklin Delano Roosevelt is the epitome of the modern president. And so basically since FDR forward, the president has been clearly the most powerful individual in this country.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of being the most powerful individual in the world, I would say that came about at the time of World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Because for most of our nation's history, we did not want to be involved in the world's affairs. We
right.
just pulled back, said we're going to take care of ourselves, and what goes on where you are will corrupt us, and we don't want to be involved with that. Woodrow Wilson tried to change that, but after the war, the U.S. Senate rejected his League of Nations proposal, and so we continued to pull back. With World War II, we became the arsenal of democracy. We were the ones who provided the war material and resources to the Soviet Union and Britain to fight the war until we got into it, and then we were the nation that provided the manpower and resources to actually defeat the Nazis and the Japanese. And then at the end of World War II, Europe was devastated.
Mm-hmm.
There was no way they could continue their obligations of world leadership because they had to start focusing at home. And so we became the indispensable nation at that point as we provided the economic goods that the world needed while the other nations started to develop. We were the military that could keep the peace. And with the arrival of the Cold War, there became the free world and the communist world.
Mm-hmm.
And due to our size, economic productivity, and our military power, the free world began to look to the United States as its leader. And then with the fall of the Soviet Union, we became, instead of just the leader of the free world, the leader of the world.
Mm-hmm.
To where if there is ever a crisis that occurs in the world today, they don't look to Moscow, they don't look to London, they don't look to Berlin, or Tokyo, or even Beijing.
Right.
They look to the United States to take the lead in helping to solve that crisis.
We're hated and loved in the world,
right? Right. Yes.
Yeah.
I think to a certain extent they don't always like what we do. But everyone loves the ideals of the American nation. That's what many people want to aspire to be on
right.
some level.
Right. How long does it take usually for history to bear out whether a president was, you know, good, bad, productive, unproductive? About how long does that take usually?
I think we have a pretty good sense when a presidency ends about how they will be rated, though it's probably another generation or two before we begin to develop that final verdict. And it takes that long for a couple of reasons. One, the people who are writing as during the presidency and as soon as it's over tends to be partisans one way or the other. And so they've got a slightly biased view. They're trying to shape how historians and other people will look at presidents in the future. But it's also after a generation or after 25 years, presidential records become available.
Mm.
They are protected for personal, political, and national security reasons for a certain period of time. And due to the wealth of data that we have available now, it takes a while for us to sift through all of those resources. I mean, Harry Truman left office with like 20% approval,
mm-hmm.
but now he's considered one of the near great presidents. Dwight Eisenhower is someone who people thought was just there. He was a nice guy, bumbled along, and everything tended to work out. But when we went back to look at what's going on, he was actually the marionette who was kind of controlling what everyone did, to where people refer to the hidden hand presidency of Eisenhower, to where he kind of had this avuncular image to the public so that he would be the grandfather type figure,
right.
the person who still won the war, but not too political to where people would change their opinion of him. But behind closed doors, he was a very incisive individual in making decisions, assessing situations, and getting things done.
So does history always change the outlook of a presidency with time? You know, you get away from something and you think, well, you know, they weren't as bad as we thought they may have been, or actually they did some really good things. Or is that the exception to the rule, that where history will change the perception?
I think there's a couple of ways of looking at this. First, I would say that it's the unheralded presidents that have a better chance of having their reputation improved as we find out more about them. And then the other thing I guess I would say is for the others, we get to find out more about who they are and how they operated, and so we have a more nuanced approach to them. So, but for the ones that are well known that make that mark, you've got people like LBJ and Richard Nixon. We still know what they're going to be known for.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, with LBJ, you have the Great Society, you have civil rights, you have voting rights,
Vietnam,
and Medicare and Medicaid, and then you have Vietnam
right.
and the help undermining public trust in the presidency.
Right.
You've got Richard Nixon, who Watergate, that's what he will always
yeah.
be known for. But he also created the EPA, opened the U.S. to China.
Right.
He consolidated the Great Society instead of trying to tear it down. So we get a more nuanced approach with time, but still, even with someone like Nixon and LBJ, they still have a mixed record. And then with Nixon, you look at how he tried to improve his reputation in his post-presidency residency. I think to a certain extent, as we look at the current or the past few recent presidents, I think Bill Clinton will probably decline in how people view him.
Really?
Yeah. Well,
interesting.
Well, in the sense of his big claims, the economy did well, but we don't measure great presidents by whether the economy did well. I mean, think about Washington. I mean, he established the precedents for the presidency. Lincoln saved the Union. FDR, he saved capitalism, while those near greats are the ones who dominated the political scene, created a governing philosophy that basically controlled politics for a generation or so. If you look at Bill Clinton, the economy is good, yes. The deficits, I think people and welfare reform, the fact that he controlled deficits or balanced the budget and welfare reform, if you look at it, that was a largely a congressional Republican-driven agenda that he signed onto. He vetoed welfare reform and balanced budget two or three times before he finally signed those. Mm. So his biggest claim that would have been his was he moved the Democratic Party to the center to make it more electable to where it might be socially moderate but financially conservative. But if you look at the election of President Barack Obama and the policies that he has pursued, he has rejected the Clinton approach to create a more progressive vision and a more socially liberal vision, which due to the rise of young people who are more socially libertine, minorities and women, that's going to be the future of the Democratic Party more than a Clinton conception. So if you look at it from that perception, Clinton's evaluation in time is just going to go down. So it's the best it's going to be for Bill Clinton. And then you take someone like George Bush. I think in the end, he's not going to be considered as bad as he is now, but he may not be considered much better. I think if you look at what his positive accomplishments is the institutions and other things that he established to fight the war on terror. Because while Barack Obama basically said, I'm going to get rid of all this, he's basically adopted
everything.
Everything, yes. And so I think he can be – his reputation can be raised because of that. But it's also what role does the war on terror play in the future?
Right.
If it's something that becomes less important, then yes, he established a framework to deal with that. But it's not something that is pressing or something that is guiding our national debate or even our foreign policy. It all depends upon how things work out.
Why is everything seemingly so partisan these days?
Because of the polarization in the nation. Basically, because of the reforms like the Voting Rights Act and other things that LBJ pursued, we see that the conservatives have migrated to the Republican Party, liberals to the Democratic Party. Remember that the parties in the post-war period were ideologically diverse. You had liberal Republicans who were just as liberal as the most liberal Democrats, people like Jacob Javits or maybe Nelson Rockefeller. And then on the conservative side in the Democratic Party, you had the South, the conservative the Democratic congressmen and senators were all conservative, basically due to changes of providing African Americans the right to vote, the fact that they started exercising that vote. It forced those older conservative Democrats to either retire or to moderate their positions. And so when you have that combined with the culture wars, which where the South was more conservative, the rest of the nation probably a little bit less so, and the aftermath of Vietnam and the role that national security played, would we be a hawkish nation or a democratic nation, you begin to see the equivalence of the Javits and the Rockefellers move to the Democratic Party and the equivalence of the conservative Democrats move to the Republican Party, to where the two parties are so polarized that there's no overlap between them in the House or the Senate. So you've got the two parties which have different visions for America that are diametrically opposed to each other. There is very little room for them to compromise with each other because it's either this or that, and the other one is wrong. It's just that contrary to what you believe. And because the elites are so polarized, that begins to filter down to the grassroots level itself.
Has the media done anything to contribute to this polarization?
Yes. I mean, there's no doubt about that. And it's the media's fault, but it's also our fault. So in the fact that we're not being the citizens who seek out the information that we need. But yes, the media has played a prominent role in the sense that we now have what Mark Halperin refers to the freak show, to where politics is more about personal destruction, that people are not just wrong on policy, but they are morally flawed individuals. And then you don't want to negotiate or even associate with people like that. And if you look at what goes on in the media, you have a conservative media, you have a liberal media.
Right.
And you watch what you
feel most comfortable watching, really.
Feel most comfortable watching or listening or even reading to.
Right.
And look at the books or movies that come out.
Right.
You've got Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11, which basically says Bush was behind the 9/11 bombings.
Right.
Or look at anything that Ann Coulter writes, you know, slander, how to talk to a liberal if you must, treason.
Right.
I mean, these are things which if people read this, saying this is what conservatives believes, then you're going to think that, and it leads to the incivility that we have. And so you look at that, you look at narrowcasting. I mean, look at when we grew up, there were three stations, I mean four, but three, ABC, CBS, and NBC. Everyone watched those.
Right.
They had to appeal to a broad audience for them to be successful.
Right.
So they had to be more nonpartisan. But with narrowcasting, there's 120 channels, and if you don't want to watch news, there's sports, there's home improvement.
There's Honey Boo Boo.
Oh, yes. There's Honey Boo Boo to where people can ignore that and focus on what they like. And though I would say while we complain about this, partisan press is actually the norm in American history, and a more objective press is unusual in most of our history.
Right. And take us back 100 years. How does a campaign of, say, 2012 compared to a campaign at the turn of the 20th century? Were there similarities and all this kind of snarkiness going on, and we just didn't have 24-hour cable channels to show us this, or was it more statesmanlike?
No.
Or is that a romantic view of it?
I think that's a romantic view of it. I kind of like a quote by a former speaker, Thomas Brackett Reed of Maine. He said, a statesman is nothing but a dead politician. His basic idea is the politicians who we think are these great statements, they played the game as well and better than most everyone else to where they could accomplish the things that we appreciate. Mm-hmm. But when we look back at things 20, 30, 50, 100 years later, we don't look at the things they did to get things done. We looked at the accomplishments that they achieved.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of what affects it. But if we also look back to 100 years ago, that's actually the last time we had partisan polarization as high as it is today.
Oh, really?
Right. And so the press was very partisan. The attacks on the other candidates were very partisan and ugly. In fact, studies have shown that the campaign ads, flyers, mailers, and everything else was much worse then than they are in the post-World War II era, because at that point, you would be talking to your people explicitly, not everyone else. But with TV, radio, anyone can hear it.
Right.
And if other people hear it and they don't like what they hear, it backfires and it hurts you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, our ads are much worse than they have been in the post-war period as far as that goes, and this campaign was horrible in that regard. But also, if you look back 100 years ago, there were norms that if someone won, they should be able to enact what they did. So while they were partisan and they fought it, in the end, if you had the majority, they thought you should be able to achieve what you wanted.
Mm.
And by the same token, when the other party won, that norm of reciprocity existed to where they would fight it, but they realized you had the right to implement what you did. Probably the thing I'd say that is most common is that there was that grassroots approach to politics was huge at that time.
Mm-hmm.
We're beginning to see a greater focus on grassroots approach to politics in terms of developing an organization to get out the vote.
Mm-hmm.
So while some things change, sometimes they stay the same.
Yeah.
And the things that have worked 100 years ago basically still work
right.
today.
Right. Do you think the Electoral College is still the best way to elect the president?
There's no perfect way to choose our leaders.
Mm-hmm.
If we eliminate the Electoral College, then basically we're giving more power to the large states. You have to get more votes than anyone else,
mm-hmm.
which means you're going to spend your time in Florida,
California,
New York. Texas, New York.
Yeah.
You're going to ignore states that get a lot of play today, like Iowa
mm-hmm.
or Colorado,
right.
New Hampshire, and other places. Versus today with the Electoral College, we have states that will go either red or blue. Everyone knows it, and so they focus on those 8 to 12 swing states, which
right.
gives them greater influence than others. They're both flawed systems in various different ways, and we're never going to find a perfect system.
Right, but it's what we have.
It's what we have, and changing it would be very difficult. The closest that we have gotten to people change here recently is some states have said that if enough states approve a popular vote for that they would give their electoral college votes to the person who wins the most popular votes, then mm-hmm. that's how they would distribute theirs. And then there are some Republicans discussing these days about allocating electoral votes based on who wins the congressional district
mm-hmm.
rather than the statewide vote, because due to Republicans' advantage in redistricting in after the 2010 elections, if they chose electoral college votes by district, not by statewide, Mitt Romney would have took the oath of office yesterday.
Hmm. Wow. Now, something I've often thought about and wondered about, if John F. Kennedy had not been assassinated, how would we be a different country now? Any thoughts on that?
I think it's hard to say on some level. I'm someone who is not as impressed with John Kennedy as other people.
Well, did his assassination put him in some category that maybe he did not deserve as far as a presidency? It made him a myth.
A myth. Well, I think to a certain extent, I will give John Kennedy credit for being able to speak and touch a chord with the public to where they would want to do things that he wanted. Ronald Reagan had some of the same attributes in his ability to move people. But the difference between Ronald Reagan and JFK is Reagan was actually able to get major legislative accomplishments through Congress. JFK did not get much done. JFK reluctantly embraced civil rights because he needed to win the southern states
mm-hmm.
to get reelected in 1964. And the people around JFK tended to create this myth about him
mm-hmm.
afterwards, which has raised people's esteem of him
right.
more than I probably think is warranted, because JFK did not show the mastery of getting bills through Congress like LBJ did.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, LBJ, to his credit, took the opportunity of the assassination and what it did to to push through many of the things that liberals wanted at that time and things that needed to be done,
right,
such as civil rights and
right.
other things.
And the Voting Act of 1965.
Of 1965, Elementary Secondary Education Act right. of 1965, the Great Society programs, the Fair Housing Act of 1968, because right. he knew how to get things done.
Right.
He was
a bully, too, wasn't he?
Yes, while
he would physically intimidate people. I mean,
people talked about the Johnson treatment. There's this great picture of Johnson talking to
right.
Senator Ted Green of Rhode Island. They start face to face, and
right.
then eventually LBJ's face
yeah.
is over him, and Green is basically has his back out, looking straight up. You know, he could do that, and he was willing to punish those who went against him, reward those who went with him. He knew what moved senators and members of Congress to get things done, and he worked that. And so for those reasons, he was able to get those things done. That, and he used what happened after the assassination to run on a progressive agenda in 1964 and win a landslide to elect people who would help him achieve that. I'm not quite sure that people in Congress feared JFK, and I'm not sure that JFK would have gotten the large victory and the influx of new liberal members that LBJ was able to get to help enact that. So it's what could have been. We never do know. I think eventually the things that LBJ got accomplished would have been done at some point,
mm-hmm.
but maybe not as quickly or with the strength
mm-hmm.
of with provisions as strong as they were in those bills.
Well, let's fast forward to now and talk about the progressive liberal Democratic president in the office. Now, what are the challenges that you see are facing him in his second term?
Well, let me talk a little bit about his inauguration because I
okay.
think – and then I'll get to that because I think he set up where he wants the country to go in
mm-hmm.
that. Basically, the Democrats and frankly Republicans have been talking about trying to having a realigning moment to make one party or the other the majority for a generation or two. I think President Obama has a slightly better chance of that due to what has gone on. Due to the financial crisis in 2008 and the fact that people were just tired of Bush and the war in 2008, that the Republican Party has been repudiated by the public on some level. We can see that in the sense that 4 years later, more people blame Bush and the Republicans for our economic struggles instead of Barack Obama. And the Democrats have blamed the problems on Republican deregulatory policy. They blame the deficit on the Bush tax cuts, on not paying for the war. They say they blame the fact that we haven't done many of the things that we need to on the Republicans' party concern for the rich, to where the approval of the Republican Party, I think I looked at this morning, is around 26%, disapproval
wow.
is 49%,
mm.
while the Democratic favorable to unfavorable is like 48-36. So the Democratic Party is in a better position.
Mm-hmm.
And so with the Republican agenda repudiated on some level,
mm-hmm.
Barack Obama has the ability to reframe the political debate, not just today,
mm-hmm.
but for years to come. And so I think if you look at his inaugural address yesterday, you see the governing philosophy that he wants to guide politics over the next 30, 40 years. I think even if he's not able to accomplish it today, he has provided a roadmap for other presidents to come. I mean, let's look at what's gone on. Reagan came into office, as you may recall, and he said, government's not the solution to our
right.
problems. Government is the problem.
Right.
And so that anti-government mentality, when people buy that, it means they're leery
right.
of government activism. Barack Obama came into office and used government to try to make a difference. I mean, a stimulus package
right.
to get the economy going, universal health care reform to provide a more secure safety net. And if you look at what he talked about yesterday, he tried to change how people view politics. He took an incontrovertible point about the Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal,
right.
and said, this is the guiding star of American progress from that time forward.
Right.
And he linked that idea of equality to Lincoln's ending slavery,
mm-hmm.
the
well, Seneca Falls.
Yeah, well, I mean,
Selma, Alabama,
and
Stonewall.
Stonewall. I mean, he made that connection. He made connections to Teddy Roosevelt's Square Deal, Woodrow Wilson's New Freedoms, FDR's New Deal, LBJ's Great Society.
Right.
So that when America has progressed, it's when government has moved to promote equality. And the implicit claim he has here is that his move to raise taxes on the rich for universal health care reform is all part and parcel of that, that it is true to the founders' ideals mm-hmm. and to the great and to the traditions of American history.
Right.
And thus his current proposals for climate change, for immigration reform, equal pay, gay rights, for poverty alleviation,
yeah.
this is part and parcel. He even went so far as to say that our personal freedoms are only secured by collective action.
Mm-hmm.
And Republicans have used liberty and freedom as you are imposing upon that. You should try to prevent that. He's saying you can only be personally free if everyone is equal, to where if he can have people think that equality is more important than freedom, then that makes it more difficult for Republicans to oppose him.
Mm-hmm.
And so you see that he knows that the arc of history on some level is
right.
moving toward him, as young women and minorities are the future,
right.
and they support policies closer to what he wants. So he's trying to force he's had an aggressive, uncompromising strategy since he's been reelected
mm-hmm.
to force Republicans to move closer to him.
Yeah.
He realizes that the same thing the Republicans realize, that they are a minority party nationally and they must change to appeal to these groups.
Mm-hmm.
So he's saying, you come close to me or I'm going to hit you over the head.
Right.
And the closer they move to him, his legislation becomes bipartisan and he can claim his liberal agenda is actually centrist. And so he moves political discourse to the left. Now, he does face, I think, several problems in trying to achieve these grand ambitions. One, House Republicans are stuck between short-term incentives to defend against a primary challenge and their long-term challenge to adapt to a changing America. I think legislatively, he's not going to be able to accomplish much in the House because there's only four Republicans who serve in districts that Barack Obama won in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
They've got no reason to cooperate with him. On the other hand, there's 17 House Democrats who represent districts that Mitt Romney won,
mm-hmm.
and there will be a lower Democratic turnout in 2014, which endangers them, which means they're not going to support it. And in the Senate, you have six Democrats up in 2014 in deep red states.
Mm-hmm.
We're not talking swing states. We're talking red states, mm-hmm. Arkansas, Louisiana, Alaska,
mm-hmm.
Montana, South Dakota,
yeah.
to where they're going to be concerned about raising taxes, gun control,
right.
and other things. And then you've got three Democrats in swing states who have to be concerned, to where legislatively he's not going to accomplish that much. So that's a problem. I think some other problems he'll have is the fact that we have large deficits. We mm-hmm. have a debt, so people are not going to want to spend more,
right.
which means with scarce resources, the Democratic coalition might fight among themselves about who gets funded.
Well, do you think people are becoming more suspicious with government?
I think to a certain extent that Americans have always been suspicious of government.
Right.
I mean, remember that our Constitution is set up to limit what right. government does, and that there's right. been an anti-government feeling ever since the beginning.
Right.
It becomes stronger or lesser depending upon the times.
Yeah, yeah. And with all of these challenges, do you foresee the United States to keep its place in the world as world leader in, say, the next 10, 20 years, or do you think China will overtake us in some ways? I mean, do you obviously, great civilizations of the Roman Empire mm-hmm. and all that, you know, and America obviously has been compared to that on many occasions. But do you foresee the day where the United States will implode?
I'm not quite sure we will implode. I think the reason we will not implode is that elections are a self-correcting mechanism. If we go too far, elections bring in new people and it leads to change on some level. I think the United States currently is still the indispensable nation.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the president is trying to step back from the global role that we play and let international institutions and other play a larger role, which allows a nation like China to exercise more power. But it's not just China if you're creating international institutions and giving them more power that plays a role. You also have the other rising nations, whether it's India, Brazil, whether it's the nations of the Middle East with their oil wealth who can
right.
Pursue more power. And so the question is, if they have more power, they're going to want to have more influence, which means will the international regimes continue to promote values that Americans support or values that support what they want. And so I think we're still the indispensable nation. I think if you look at his new foreign policy team, you have a Secretary of State who wants to go and fix problems around the world in John Kerry, a prospective Secretary of State. You have a former Senator Chuck Hagel, who will probably be confirmed as Secretary of Defense, who is very dovish about military intervention, who believes the Defense Department budget is bloated and needs to be cut. And you have a director of the CIA who's basically the person behind the drone war who says, let's remove boots on the ground
mm-hmm.
and use technology to do this. So you see an intentional pulling back of the American footprint around the world in that respect. But still, there's no one to replace us at this point. But 25, 50 years from now, it will be very different.
One thing about the future, if you had to call it right now, who would you put in the presidential race of 2016?
Well, I think if we look at the Democrats, Joe Biden's making every sign that he wants to run. He'll be 74, 75 at that time, which would make him the oldest elected president if he won. There's still talk about Hillary Clinton. I'm not as sure that Hillary wants to run as much as Bill wants her to run.
Mm-hmm.
Outside, so if those two run, they'll be the top tier. There are other people who are positioning themselves to run. You have people like Governor Mario Cuomo of New York,
mm-hmm.
Governor Martin O'Malley of Maryland, former Governor Mark Schweitzer, who's a more moderate type Democrat from Montana. If Hillary Clinton does not run, people are suggesting that Senator Kristen Gillibrand of New York or Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota will run. And some people think there might be a minority run of some sort. And most people are talking about Mayor Villagrosa of Los Angeles as that person. But whether you can leap from Mayor of Los Angeles to the White House, people are not sure about. In terms of the Republican Party, I think there are a lot of people who are thinking about it, but the Republican Party still needs to figure out where it wants to go in the future, how right. it's going to adapt to changing demographics. The people who most people think will run are Senator Marco Rubio of Florida, Governor Bobby Jindal of Louisiana, Congressman Paul Ryan of Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
Most people think that Senator Rick Santorum wants to run again in 4 years. Other names that have been mentioned are Governor Scott Walker of Wisconsin, assuming he wins re-election. Same with Governor John Kasich of Ohio. Senator John Thune of South Dakota has been mentioned as a potential candidate. at some point in the future. And let's see, I wouldn't be surprised if maybe someone like Tim Scott, the new senator from South Carolina, tried to use his current popularity to see if he can turn that into a presidential run.
Right. So we have maybe a couple years of a little bit of respite from all the campaigning, and then it'll start gearing up again, which is, in my opinion, way too soon. But, you know, you just get tired of this stuff.
Right.
It seems like they never end. It never ends.
It used to be we campaigned and then we governed for two years, and then the campaign would start up. But we began with the perpetual campaign when Bill Clinton, and for good reasons, I think, moved his campaign war room tactics into the White House to constantly respond to things,
right,
to where we spent less time governing, more time campaigning to getting ready for the next 4 years. And I don't think that particularly serves any of us well.
Yeah. Well, before we let you go, we've got a new segment. It's called Rapid Fire.
Oh.
And we're going to ask you just a few questions. And the easy questions, and all you have to do
is give us
your answers. For the most part, what we've discussed.
All right.
Who is your favorite all-time president?
It's hard to say. Everyone's favorite is Lincoln.
Lincoln, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Who is the most overrated president?
I'd say JFK.
JFK, okay. And lastly, who is your Super Bowl picks?
My Super Bowl picks. All right. We've got the Ravens versus the Niners.
Yes.
I don't really care who wins. I'm going to say the Ravens. Defense wins.
Okay. You heard it here. Ravens. Ravens. And we have appreciated you being with us. It's been fascinating.
It's been my pleasure.
And we will be back right after this. We want to thank Dr. Sean Evans for being with us on today's podcast. A lot of interesting information.
It was very educational. That was a great podcast.
Lots of interesting things. He also has given us some resources that we will post on the blog for the podcast. Yeah. If anyone would like to see what he likes to look at and read.
Yeah, he said he recommends using a broad kind of casting a broad net to, so you're not getting all your information from one source, but, you know, look at the liberal, look at the conservative, the midstream, you know.
Yeah.
Checking out multiple sources. And so he's given us some resources that he uses to kind of check his news and gain information.
And unlike football season, the political season does go on
24/7, 365.
All year round.
Yeah.
Anyway, some very interesting, very fascinating.
Yeah.
Enjoyed the conversation.
That's great.
And we hope that you enjoyed the conversation, and we thank you for listening, and we will see you next time.